Good morning. I have a couple of points before we start officially. First, I'd like to thank you again for that very lovely surprise last night, of which I truly knew nothing. Even as it was taking place, I didn't entirely get what was taking place until I could abstract from two concretes that there was some progression here or something in common. But I did deeply appreciate it, and I think the gift is very beautiful, and I want to thank you all very much. Now, a practical matter, you will be getting a refund for the fact that you signed up for 10 classes and you only received 9. We think the fairest way to do this is your original enrollment fee was made of two elements. One was the costs of producing and distributing and administering the book, which were borne by Professor Buechner, and that you have received 100% of the value of because you got the book. The other was the fee that I am being paid as a lecturer. Since I've delivered only 9/10 of that, we figured that the fairest thing is to refund 1/10 of my fee to you. Now that comes to $20 a person. And you will have that refunded to you. Now, some people have protested or have said they don't want it or they're going to give it to the Ayn Rand Institute. You can do whatever you want with it, including burn it if you don't want to, but this has to be a commercial proposition. If I charge money and don't deliver, I can't take the money, nor do I want to make a donation or pressure you to make a donation. Somebody, I'm sure, is going to, on their own, circulate some kind of sign up if you want to contribute your 20 to the Institute. If you want to do that without any pressure at all, obviously that's your prerogative, but there's no implication whatever, you know, that this is a scam to get you to give $20 to the Institute. It's your money, and don't be pressured. If you want to, fine, but that was entirely not my idea or the Institute's. It's what you want to do. In any event, I'm sorry that I have to put you in this position where you missed the 10th, but at least financially, it won't be uncompensated. All right, Walter, we're ready to. And now officially, good morning. Because of the unexpected change in schedule, we won't be giving the 4 hours to this chapter 5, but only one class of 2 hours, and I'm going to still try to cover the chapter, but obviously with less time for each section. First, a few preliminary remarks in the nature of an overview. This chapter is the final epistemological integration. We put together chapters 2, 3, and 4, the main conclusion of them, and the result is that's what reason is. 2 tells us the data from which reason begins, percepts. 3 tells us the form in which those data are integrated and retained, concepts. 4 tells us the method of using these tools, concepts, in order to acquire knowledge. That gives us every essential element of reason. And therefore, 5 is simply putting it together into this is our cognitive faculty. Now, many years ago, when I was in the course that I gave in 76, my best understanding of the topics that are now in chapter 5 was something like this. Emotions, I consider that's part of the nature of man. So that went in the lecture on man. The arbitrary, I didn't know entirely what to do with. It stood in my mind as, this is an interesting idea of Ayn Rand that has to be included somewhere. So it was one of those transitions where I got to the end of one topic and I said, now let's look at this, which is very important. I didn't know where to put it in. Reason is man's only means of knowledge. I treat it in effect as polemics against mysticism. What's wrong with mysticism? And that's how I used it. But you see, that way of treating these issues, and of course then certainty was just the answer to skepticism. So it was a mixture of disorganization, randomness, polemics, spread across different points, and you couldn't see the total issue. Now you see the present structure, it makes the relation of these topics, ties them again into a unity. If this is what reason is, then the first obvious question is, are there other elements within our conscious life that are not reason and that we need to know about in terms of epistemology? Do they have any cognitive function? How are they related to reason? And that, of course, leads us to the main topic there is what are emotions. So it follows in order to give an inventory of consciousness and to show what the relation of the non-reason element is to reason. And then, of course, from the nature of what an emotion is, we will be led to the conclusion, well, this can't be a means of knowledge. That will simply follow from our analysis of what is the nature of an emotion, what is its relation to reason, which we've already established as our means of knowledge. And then, of course, we'll follow, well, what is the proper attitude to take to claims which are based solely on emotion? And that will be the third point, and that will be the statement of what is wrong with the arbitrary, which, of course, will follow directly from our previous discussion of context, because the essence of the arbitrary is the non-contextual, that which is sundered from its place in the body of knowledge and just put forth as a revelation, that is right away out. And then, finally, we have now surveyed the total. This is our faculty of knowledge. This is how we acquire knowledge. This is what knowledge is. And now we're prepared to give the status of the final product. Can we trust it or not? Is it reliable or not? Does it meet the test necessary for 100% conviction or not? And that is like the final conclusion, the topic of certainty. That, I believe, has to be the last topic of epistemology. In the same way that happiness is the last topic in ethics. In other words, first you give a code of values, and then if you have the right values, you say, if you live by them, you will reap the result, which is complete fulfillment, joy, etc., happiness. If you have the wrong values, you'll say life is misery, and you may possibly say happiness comes in the next life from a supernatural connection, but not on this one. Now, there's an exact parallel in epistemology. If you have the right relation to reality cognitively, then the result will be epistemological happiness or fulfillment, in other words, knowledge, certainty. If not, you will end up with either outright skepticism or the idea the only way you can have this cognitive fulfillment is through the supernatural, through some form of mysticism or revelation. So I actually lectured on this at the last conceptual conferences when I talked about certainty and happiness. So I've elaborated this point at some length, but I do think it's true that logically certainty is the final cashing in. Once you know that, you're ready to start acquiring knowledge rather than studying the process of acquiring. And of course, as you know, the topic of certainty is itself heavily derivative from the contextual nature of knowledge. So as with the arbitrary, so with certainty, you could not discuss those topics except having first established the relational nature of knowledge, the issue of context, and more broadly, the issue of the method of cognition. And therefore, for many reasons, certainty has to be relegated to the finale. Now, this chapter, as I think I indicated to you, started in my mind as largely polemic. So what's wrong with mysticism and what's wrong with skepticism? I hadn't got clearly in mind what you really needed to do. I gradually saw the necessity of a positive presentation. First, the inventory of consciousness, specifically what other faculties do we have and do they have a cognitive role? And then this question that I think you'd have to raise if you could speak at all, even on a desert island. Knowledge is limited. That's the key issue in regard to certainty. We constantly gain more. What implications, if any, does that have for our knowledge? What responsibility, if any, does it impose on us? In other words, are there responsibilities inherent in the fact that we have human knowledge as against omniscience? And I think that that is necessary other than on polemical grounds in order to draw out the full implications of what we have to do in order to call our knowledge knowledge. So it really is a further elaboration of knowledge as contextual, but it's an important one that would leave a gap or confusion in your own mind even on a desert island. Now, since this is a chapter on reason, we may as well look at the outset on 228 to 9, that bottom paragraph 228, because that kind of summarizes all the preceding chapters from the point of view of reason as the fact-oriented faculty. It begins with facts. That's the sensory data. How do we know those are facts? We've already discussed that. It organizes these data in accordance with facts. That is the actual mathematical relationships that we use as a basis for conceptualization. It's guided in its method by the fundamental fact, the law of identity, which is the root of logic. And the method demands that every cognition go back to facts. That's the issue of reduction. So no matter where you look at it, beginning, middle, or end, form, matter, method, you can't get around one thing. Reason is the existence-oriented faculty. It is the faculty that starts, goes according to, relates, and comes back to existence. And thus, if anybody says, why should I accept reason, as I say here, that is exactly the same as saying, why should I accept existence? And there is no answer because there is no such why. Until you accept existence, you cannot ask why. Here we go back to the first axiom of chapter one, existence exists. So we have actually reduced reason now all the way back through its various elements to an axiom. Now, our questions are reason as against what else? That's our first question. And of course, the crucial issue is emotion. So let's look now at the first sequence, and we'll try to do this by looking at a sequence, taking some questions, and then going to the next, and so on, and then with whatever time we have at the end, open for general questions. Now, this first sequence, I think we can get through pretty rapidly. This is really elementary, standard objectivism, that emotions are not primaries, that they derive from evaluative and other conclusions, which are automatized in your subconscious. I think the only point worth pausing on, which I think is new, it was new to me, is the one that starts on the bottom of 237 on to 238, which is a new connection to me. Everywhere I look, I see, at the mind-body dichotomy in all its forms, I see the theory of concepts as I started to write this book. We saw that under the theory-practice dichotomy, and it occurred to me for the first time in writing this chapter that the reason-emotion dichotomy is another reflection of a false theory of concepts. I had never thought that before, but now I think I see that, because what in essence is the distinction between reason and emotion as the advocates of the dichotomy think of it? They think of reason as dealing with abstractions. That's true from Plato on down, the world of forms. It's the intellectual, it's, quote, pure, it's non-materialistic. In other words, reason pertains to thought, to abstractions, to concepts. But emotions are evoked by what? Well, the standard answer on the part of the people who believe in the dichotomy, they deny, of course, that ideas have anything to do with emotions. They say you have experiences, and that engenders emotions. You see something, and you feel fear. You hear something, somebody points a gun or whatever. In other words, the standard view is that emotions are invoked by percepts. And, of course, there's an element of truth to that. Every emotion begins with a concrete, either a percept or at least the image of one. So If you come to the phenomenon of emotions with a split between percepts and concepts, you think they belong to two opposite worlds because your theory of concepts is either subjectivist or intrinsicist. You do not see concepts as integrations of percepts, as inherently wedded to percept, then you will divide man neatly into the part that responds to percepts and the part that goes off in the clouds manipulating concepts. And then if somebody says to you, well, but it's your concepts that lead to your emotions, you'll say, that's fantastic. What do my concepts got to do with this world and my experiences? And then, of course, the cherry on the cake is you'll find cases where it seems that your reaction to your experiences is in conflict with your ideas because you don't really know your ideas. And it's the alleged conflict between reason and emotion, and then the nail is in the coffin, and the case is closed. So I really do think that this is a very, very major issue, which has had such damaging consequences throughout history, it goes back to the theory of concepts. And if you had a fully valid integration of concepts and percepts, you could not have the view that emotions are blind consequences of percepts which have nothing to do with concepts, because you would know that human consciousness integrates its percepts through concepts, and that therefore percepts for man means percepts conceptualized. And therefore, if a response is to percepts, it has to be a response through concepts. And that's the last paragraph in that sequence on 238. The last sentence, couple of sentences. Man's conclusions have the power to generate his emotions precisely because they are not free-floating. They're not revelations or constructs detached from the physical world, from the arena of action, from the perceptual world. They are only a form of integrating percepts. And if you really hold that all the way, you cannot, you can't succumb. I don't think you would have any temptation to succumb to the idea of emotions as detached from thought. That is basically the only new point. The rest, I think, is as primal objectivism as this book gets. Now, I will entertain questions for a few minutes on the section on emotions before we go further. I don't mean to, you know, eliminate questions by saying if you ask a question, you're necessarily on a primitive level. I'm just, you know, there could be all kinds of more sophisticated questions. I just was saying I'm going over this quickly because there's not much that's in this that you wouldn't already know very well. Yes?
I was wondering why you put this section first in this chapter.
Well, I put this first because you can't talk about the cognitive function or lack thereof of emotions until we know what they are and how they're related to our cognitive faculty. So first we have to know what is it, then what does it do or not do? And that leads us to reason as our only means of knowledge, not emotion. And then what is wrong, and what happens if people do follow emotion? And that's the issue of the arbitrary. But the whole thing has to begin with the inventory, and the inventory really means reason with its various appurtenances and then emotion. So we have to start with this. This was originally written to go under in the chapter on man, and I pulled it out because I think it's essential to epistemology. Now, when we get to the chapter on man, which you don't get to in this book, of course, we draw on a lot of the conclusions from metaphysics and epistemology, but it's organized specifically now as a study, not just of one of man's faculties, namely consciousness, that's what epistemology studies, but of the total entity. What are his attributes as far as philosophy studies them? And that's where, for the first time in the next chapter, which you don't get, we go into topics like man is a living entity. What is the nature of a living organism? How does it differ from others, etc.? Reason is man's means of survival. Now, up to now, we've said really through this chapter, reason is man's means of knowledge. But we haven't said anything about survival because we haven't even introduced the distinction between life and death yet. We haven't come to conclusions yet. We're learning how to come to conclusions, you see. The next chapter also will go to reason as an attribute of the individual and the issue of the individual versus the group and so on. All of that is later comes under man. And at one point I had the nature of emotions in there, but I now think that the sheer study of the faculty of cognition, of knowledge, requires for the completeness that you study. You don't have to know that man is living for that, but you have to know what you're going to do with the other things in consciousness, you see. So it's for that reason that this has to go here. Who else? Cynthia? Yeah.
On page 235, you say men have the ability to accept contradictions without knowing it.
Yeah.
And that sounds almost like a loophole that the Freudians or mystics would point at. It makes me uncomfortable. Because
how do you know you're not doing it?
Yeah.
Well, you say it makes you uncomfortable when I say men have the ability to accept contradictions without knowing it. How do you know you're not doing it? Well, here I would say the onus of proof is on he who says you're doing it. If you have to go by the total context. The only case where you have grounds to suspect it is if you see something anomalous the other person, whoever it is, behavior. If you would expect to react a certain way or to act a certain way and you find a reluctance or the opposite, something you can't yourself explain, then you have grounds to say, well, maybe I hold a subconscious contradiction. But if you know what you think and you know what you expect to feel and you do, there's no loophole, there's no grounds there to say, maybe I really have a contradiction I don't know about. It would be exactly analogous to you give an argument. You've integrated, you've followed all the epistemological rules, and somebody says, well, after all, man can make a mistake. How do you know you didn't? And there, the point that's really relevant is what I say under the discussion of possibility. Man can, or man, it's possible for man to do X, doesn't mean it's possible that you are doing X. To get to a hypothesis about a particular, you have to have evidence drawn from that particular case. It's not sufficient to have a generalized statement that a species has a certain potential. So, if you keep that in mind, I don't think you should be worried about that. Anybody else on this sequence? Okay, I'm going to go merrily along. Yeah. Oh, there was one? Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
29, you say, one cannot be the proof that reason is reliable because reason is the faculty of truth.
Right.
One must accept and use reason in any attempt to prove its
prevention.
Doesn't that mean that reason is axiomatic?
Reason is axiomatic, yes, in the sense that you can't question the validity of your cognitive faculty except by using it. If you're going to define axiomatic as anything that is a precondition of going on and acquiring knowledge, obviously yes. But that doesn't mean that we can't validate reason and do it in a more complex way than you validate what we normally call axioms. That is, in the case of reason, it is not an axiomatic concept. You see, identity, you just look. You implicitly get the concept from opening your eyes at the appropriate stage. And existence and consciousness. When you get to reason, that is a very sophisticated advanced concept which has to have some idea of the perceptual element, the conceptual element, and the methodological, logical element. And therefore, it's a long stage before mankind or an individual reaches that concept. And from that point of view, it is the opposite of an axiom. The only resemblance to an axiom is once we engage in cognition, we have to use our consciousness, including our faculty, which is reason. And if anyone comes to you as an adult and says, okay, let's start from scratch. Throw out reason. Give me a proof that reason is acceptable. Well, what am I going to use as a proof, and how did he ask that question? You see? That does not, however, mean that reason is an axiomatic concept, if you get that distinction, because it's a later development, and it takes a great deal of validation to validate all of its elements, define them, and reach them. So as I put it here, we have to use reason, but then using it, we can identify the relationship of its various aspects to reality. So we can't do it without using it. In that sense, it's inescapable. It's a primary. But in the other sense, there's a complex development of knowledge to get to. All right, now let's go on to the next sequence, which is reason as man's only means of knowledge. And here, of course, it follows from the nature of emotions. And I think the best statement there is the very bottom of the first paragraph on 238. Emotion is a faculty not of perception, meaning by perception there, awareness of reality. Not of perception, but of reaction to one's perceptions. And the crucial sentence is, this kind of faculty, that is a faculty not of outer awareness, but simply of reaction, has no power of observation and no volition. Therefore, it's sunk on both counts as a cognitive faculty. It has, as I underscore there, no means of access to reality. Whatever you feed into the mind, that will produce the emotion. The emotion cannot verify itself. It is simply the end result of what you feed it intellectually. It has no choice, no way to establish itself in contact with reality. Now, the essence of volition, if you remember, we discussed in chapter 2, was specifically our ability to focus our cognitive faculty on reality. The choice in the exercise of our mind, and specifically the choice to attune it to reality or not. That's the only volition that we can establish, and that is the nature of the volition. That volition applies only to the faculty of reason. It does not apply to derivative consequences of it. And therefore, emotion is in the position, it's not automatically infallible, but it has no choice about what it does. And consequently, emotion per se can't be relied upon as a means of cognition. And I think the whole key is in that paragraph. Now, a couple of pages over in regard to the people who try to use something other than reason. There's a good tie-in on page 241, the top paragraph. This is a tie-in basically between mysticism and our earlier discussion of reduction, and this is new. Reason involves percept, concept, logic, and each of those concepts, that is the concept of percept, of concept, of logic, are derivable from and reducible, directly or indirectly, to the data of observation. We had a whole chapter on how you take concept, the concept, back to the data of reality. And we had a whole chapter on how you take logic and all its various forms back to the data of reality. So when we talk about reason, every element of that concept is itself reducible ultimately back to direct observation. So all of the concepts are objectively identifiable. But now we're talking about the type of person who says, I'm out, I don't believe in reason. Down with percepts, concepts, and logic. But he also says typically, I don't go by emotion either. You say, well, then what is it that you are for? And then there's all these terms, intuition, revelation, whatever, the dialectic process, or all the rest of it. Now, inherent in the fact that these concepts, so-called, are supposed to name a faculty that transcends reason and all its elements, there's no way to bring these faculties, these alleged concepts, back down to perceptual data. If I say to you, what is intuition? How do you distinguish a revelation from a non-revelation? There's only one answer. Those who know don't need any further answer, and to those who don't, no answer is possible. You either know it or you don't. That's it. You can't reduce it to percepts, because of course if you reduced it to percepts, what would you have done? You would have made it non-mystical and assimilated it back into the faculty of reason. And that's exactly what these people are trying to escape. And therefore, all of their alleged higher faculties are necessarily undefinable. That is to say, non-reducible. They can't bring those concepts back to perceptual data, or they would lose their mysticism. But that means they're necessarily unable to give any content except by one guideline. What guides them in the formation and use of these invalid concepts? Not the data of reality, but the only other thing that's left in consciousness once you throw out reason, and that is emotion. So they claim that they've got this super faculty, but it really is nothing but going according to their feelings. And this is the formal proof that if you don't go by reason, you are an emotionless. There's nothing else you can be. And we do it, you see, through the principle of reduction, which was new to me, so I assume to some of you as well. Of course, I think it's pretty much clear that emotions are not tools of cognition to this audience. I think it may be a helpful point on 242, and that is my comparison, which I haven't done before, near the top, between an unanalyzed emotion and a floating abstraction. Because those two have a very similar status. By an unanalyzed emotion, I mean an emotion where you don't know its roots and you haven't validated the ideas at its root. You just feel something. And of course, by a floating abstraction, we mean an abstraction that is unrelated to reality. Now, those two are really two versions of the same type of thing. One on the emotional, one on the cognitive level, but nevertheless, what they have in common is both of them are mental states disconnected from reality. And therefore, the idea of going by emotions as a means of cognition, that is, taking them as primaries, not attempting to validate them by reference to reality, is exactly analogous to living in a world of floating abstractions or having a whole bunch of higher level propositions that you don't bother to prove or relate to reality. It means retreating into your consciousness and manipulating the data of consciousness without reference to reality. And if you see what's wrong in any one of these cases, they're all in the same category. To me, that was a helpful connection. And I think I will make just one more point here. It's not directly philosophical, but in a way it is. It answers a question that I know I'm constantly asked. It's a little tangential to this section, but on the bottom of 243, I'm pretty cavalier in my statement here that if you have a clash between your feelings and your thoughts, don't worry, just analyze and come up with a new non-contradictory integration and all will be well. And I do want to acknowledge here that that is not, I even put in parentheses there, as you see, which may be a difficult, time-consuming process. Because I don't want you to feel guilt if you find that you have a protracted, enduring conflict. That is between your thoughts and your feelings in some area. That is more than possible. In today's world, it's very, very often the norm. And it does not mean that the person, if he's trying, is dishonest or should feel guilty. These things are extremely difficult sometimes for a variety of reasons. Maybe the difficulty of diagnosis, the primitive state of psychology, the complexity of trying to introspect confused conclusions that you came to decades ago, using knowledge that you're not entirely clear about now. I mean, there's 100 reasons, but there's one in particular that I want to mention that would be inherent in trying to transform yourself psychologically that ties into what we've been saying. The more fundamental the idea that you are trying to challenge and change, the harder the job for one simple reason. What is that? The more it is at the base of your ideas, the more it is integrated to other ideas. And therefore, in order to break the hold of that false idea, if it's false, you have to separately disintegrate it. You have to chop it off from all of the ideas to which you've automatized its connection. And therefore, if it's an idea that permeates your view of life, you have a massive job of disintegration to do. And this is like the negative side of the role of integration. And I'll give you the simplest example. It's a gruesome example, but it's daily, and that is death. You all know the experience where somebody that's close to you dies, and you go through a protracted period where you just can't believe it. You cannot take it in. You know, your mind simply knows that the person is dead, but a week or a month, and you still find years sometimes. You're expecting to see the person, or you have a desire to call a person, or you think, wouldn't it be nice to let this person know such and such? And you go through a long period of re-automatization. In context after context, when you see an item of furniture, when you think of a certain address, when you go to a certain movie, etc., your mind feeds you the automatized integration. It's related to this person. And then you have to have another start and say, no, this person is dead, and sever that connection. Now, if you can imagine, and this is a common phenomenon, the length and complexity of disintegrating that person from the rest of your context so that you go on with the full grasp, conscious and subconscious, that the person is gone. That is like a paradigm or an example of what you have to go through when you try to get rid of a premise if it's deeply entrenched. You have to break all of the connections that your mind has made, because the mind is an integrating mechanism. So I'm going into this song and dance partly so you won't, you know, hold it against yourself that it takes that kind of time, but partly because I think it's an illuminating angle from which to see the omnipresence of integration. No one can escape some form of integration because the mind is an integrating mechanism. And the very problems that people have in reconditioning themselves psychologically, whatever other factors are involved, one crucial root is the fact of the amount of disintegration, which in a good sense, that you have to do in order to make a new integration. So I thought perhaps you might find this helpful as an elaboration of what we said in chapter 4, although I'm pretty much dragging it in through the heels in this context. So in sum, this chapter, this sequence tells you in effect, again, consciousness is a certain way, therefore you should function a certain way. And in this case, the point is, emotions are merely reactions to perceptions without cognitive function. Therefore, your responsibility in a cognitive process is to keep emotions separate from the process, not to rely on them, not to let them guide it. In other words, to keep sharp the distinction between reason and emotion, or logic and feeling. And that is the sum of what I want to say on this point. All right, let's take questions now on this sequence. Yeah.
I was wondering if you would say there's a connection between what you describe as reduction and the concept of differentiation. For example, when you take the main elements of a definition, we have a genus and a differentia. The differentia is used to enumerate a specific kind of entity within a genus.
No, I can't agree with you. Let me stop you right there. You're mixing contexts. Reduction is a cognitive process. Integration is a cognitive process. There's a whole bunch of different cognitive processes. It's a cross-classification to try to associate reduction with differentiation. The only way you can reduce is continuously to differentiate and integrate as you go. You have to separate out certain elements, but you have to keep in mind their connection to other elements. You couldn't take, if I follow your drift, the two main broad sweeping functions of consciousness, separation and interrelation. differentiation and integration and say, this logical process uses one and this logical process uses the other. You can't not separate it that way. It's two different perspectives. Yes?
Would it be correct to say that recognizing a contradiction automatically causes a conceptual consciousness to experience an emotion of pain?
No. Would it be correct to say that recognizing a contradiction automatically causes a conceptual consciousness to experience pain? Would that it did? First of all, there are people who delight in contradictions if they reject reason. Credo quia absurdum was Tertullian's famous battle cry. I believe it because it's absurd. He reveled in the fact that this was riddled with contradictions that made no sense whatever, destroyed man's rational faculty. Now, you could say it was highly neurotic, sick, and that he was a basically unhappy person. That's guaranteed. I mean, he'd be the first to tell you that he was miserable. But that doesn't mean that when he got a contradiction, his mind recalled, oh, no. It's on the contrary, he used it as a way of dashing this world so he could get to God. Pain is, on intellectual levels, is an issue of your values. You have to value consistency. You have to value clarity. You have to value understanding. And then, when you find a contradiction, you will be upset. You'll say, something is wrong in my thinking. Now, you may be very happy, on the other hand, to find a contradiction in somebody else's thinking. Suppose you're debating with an enemy, and it comes out and you see a contradiction, you may feel elation, say, great, I got him now. So you couldn't make such a formulation as a contradiction invokes pain. It entirely depends on your values and your context. Now, hopefully, if you're an objectivist, yeah, I don't mean you have to suffer when you have a contradiction, but that should certainly stop you short and say, God, something is wrong here. And the pain would really come in if you can't figure out what's wrong. Now, that I've gone through, you know, well, a certain formulation seems unavoidable, and in another chapter, the opposite formulation seems unavoidable. And you can't let go either, and they seem to be nakedly opposed to each other. But you always find in time that there's some switch of context, or some equivocation, or some angle, and you resolve it. But there is a period of, that definitely I would call pain. To do that when you find that. But it's not automatic in the nature of, it's an achievement to get to the point where you suffer because you're inconsistent. A great many people couldn't care less if they're inconsistent. They utter things like, well, you know, life is inherently contradictory, there's more things in this world than are dreamed of in anybody's philosophy, and who is man to make sense of it all, and mysterious contradictions of the universe and all that, you know. Okay, anything on this? Yes. Is that Ed? Yeah.
Do you think that the legitimate use, non-mystical use of the term intuition to describe the experience of having an inkling based on stored knowledge, such as a businessman says, I have a gut feeling based on my experience, this product won't sell?
Yeah. That's what Ayn Rand used to call a stomach feeling, to demystify. Is there a legitimate use of the term intuition? There is if you make it clear, but I would only do it among friends or in a jocular way. Like the other day I said about my wife, she had an intuition of what was wrong with my organization in chapter 4, which somebody in this room got annoyed over because they took it that I was talking about female intuition and putting it down. But I meant it, you know, not in a serious way. There is such a thing as automatic cognition fed to you by your mind in a certain context where you already have all the data, all the ideas, all the knowledge. And then some one thing is like Newton's apple, some one observation, the mind connects it all. The subconscious feeds all the integrating things and you suddenly see. And you may see faster than you can identify what is feeding into it. All you know is you didn't know, and bang, now you know. Now, there's no use denying that that exists. Not all conclusions are reached painstakingly, conceptually, consciously, step by step. So if you want a name for that aspect of which is the automatic functioning, the automatic cashing in on previous knowledge. You can call that intuition. But the trouble with calling it that is that the word is so prevalently used for a mystic faculty. You see, there's nothing mystic about what you're describing. That I would never in writing or in formal discussion use the term. I would say automatic subconscious integration, or just, you know, automatically available to you. Well, with that caveat, there's nothing wrong if you make your meaning clear. Next, on this sequence. Okay, let us go on then to the arbitrary. Now, here we get into something. What do we do now with claims based on emotion only? And, of course, the answer is that invalidates the claim and therefore ties into our previous discussion of logic. Logic is man's method of cognition. The arbitrary is that which is reached apart from the method of cognition, without reference to the method. Therefore, the arbitrary is obviously outside the realm of cognition. So we are simply drawing here really a consequence of what is the need of logic in chapter 4. This is a corollary. If logic is necessary, then the non-logical is out. And that's what this sequence discusses, and I discuss it at this point rather than in the preceding chapter, simply because the arbitrary is always mediated by a person's emotions. They have a whim, they have a desire, they want something to be true, so it's a form of emotionalism. And so I think that the perfect place for it is after you've covered logic and emotion, then the use of emotion to defy logic brings us to the arbitrary. Now, the sum of this issue is on 247 in the first statement. An arbitrary statement has no relation to man's means of knowledge. Because I'm not going to remind you what arbitrary means, just a categorical claim based on zero. Now, such a statement is outside of logic. There's no attempt to adduce evidence. You just say it out of the blue. There's no context. It's not based on any observations or reducible. It's no hierarchy. Well, what can you do with it? As an arbitrary statement, you can do nothing with it. While it preserves its status as arbitrary, it's literally unthinkable about, because thinking is integrating, finding evidence, relating to sense data, and this particular proposition by its very nature says sense data out, other knowledge out, reality out, human method out, now think. Well, I mean, you're stopped. If you literally understand what cognition is and what the arbitrary is, you would just stop dead and you would say, there's nothing that my mind can do. It's not that it's you think about it and you weigh it and you say, this is false. Or you think about it and you weigh it and you say, well, this is possible, but it's not probable. You do not come to any verdict. You don't even come to the verdict that it's impossible. You simply act as though nothing had been said. The view you take on it is precisely the view you took before the person uttered it. Now, what is your view at this second, right now, before I get to say the thing? Now, remember your view on the question of how many goddesses are outside the solar system. You never thought of it. You have no question. You have no position. Not even the position that is possible. It's a void, it's a nil. There's no reason ever to have a thought about that. Well, there's no more reason now that I've said it than before. And from that point of view, it simply banished. The fact that I utter it is not a basis or a reason to start thinking, gee, what do I think about this? Because you shouldn't be thinking about this. There's nothing to think about, you see. That is the whole point with the arbitrary. Now, this is why You have to reject out of hand all testimony from, for instance, religious people who claim that various miracles happen. And that's supposed to show the work of God, etc., you say. What is the basis to believe that this miracle took place? It happened. It said so in the Bible. It says so in our religious tradition. What's the basis? There is no basis. It happened. Now, you can't do anything with that. That is exactly like the claim of the gremlins or any of these other arbitrary claims. It simply has no standing. Now, if you happen to see with your own eyes, or someone that you know is reliable, a man walk on water, then as far as the percept goes, okay, you'd have to see, does he have hidden water skis? Is the surface coated with ice? So, you know, how would you explain it? But the fact is okay. But if somebody simply tells you, take it from me, I know that he walked on water, that is in the arbitrary category. And of course, this same thing is applicable, I don't have to stress, for biographical data about individuals who are dead and cannot defend themselves when their biography is written and consists of arbitrary factual claims by enemies. But I leave that to you to figure out who I could possibly be talking about. Now, I think a good line, I have a couple of good lines in this, the top of 248. One cannot allow into the realm of cognition something that defiantly repudiates every rule of that realm. And the arbitrary is not a mistake. It didn't get the dignity. It doesn't get the credit. It doesn't deserve the compliment of being called a mistake. When you call something a mistake, you have elevated it to the realm of cognition. You have said certain proper human processes have been applied to it, even if an error has been committed. The arbitrary doesn't even enter. It would be like the difference between a moral and immoral human being within the category of human as against someone who is, let us say, as an analogy, so amoral, such a monster, that you say this person is subhuman, he's bestial, he doesn't deserve even entry into the world of human beings. And that is what the analogy would be to the arbitrary versus the true and the false. That's just an analogy, of course. But it's a mistake to apply any cognitive term, like true, false, etc., to the arbitrary. And the distinction between the false and the arbitrary is discussed on 250. The importance of that distinction, the false as such always leaves you the way of finding out that you went wrong, because your method is unimpaired. But the arbitrary wipes out your means to get to contact reality. And then I think this is a really clear little example. Who would you rather work for or buy groceries from? Somebody who makes an error in counting the number of people, that is, he uses a reasonable process, but he overlooks something. Or somebody who says the room is filled with demons. Now that would be the stand-in for the arbiter. Now, then I make the point, of course, that you can sometimes, not always, take an arbitrary statement and yourself perform the act of integration that would connect it to human knowledge and thereby reveal it as either true or false. But I stand on my head to say you never have to do that. It is not your obligation logically, rationally, or epistemologically. And so do not ever feel any compulsion if somebody says there is a God. Oh, I can show that that's contradictory, because if you mean by God omnipotence, that violates the law of identity. And if you mean, you don't have to go through that whole song and dance at all. If it's arbitrary, you can just dismiss it out of hand. And in fact, as I point out here, if you go through that whole proof, that is only going to be convinced the people who have made an honest error. That is, who think that there is reason to believe in God. And you are showing them that they made a mistake. But the type of person who believes in God as arbitrary fiat, which is what faith means, true faith, not Thomas Aquinas' five proofs, that type of person is simply not open to any refutation by the nature of his view being arbitrary. And therefore, whatever you say, he'll tell you, I understand your point, but I'm using God in a higher sense. If you understood the real meaning, which of course we can't in this life, you would see that all your contradictions are completely beside the point. There is no contradiction in the higher truth, but we just, our vision is dimmed in this world. So while it's true, in other words, that you can sometimes, not always, take an arbitrary statement and connect it painstakingly to human knowledge and thereby identify its truth value, that is not in any way an obligatory thing. Ayn Rand used to call that a courtesy. She said sometimes if you respect the person and you think they're honest, as a courtesy, you can, if and when it's possible, show him by doing the integration yourself the kinds of errors he's committing. But in a great many cases, we don't have any means of integrating because the thing is simply so undefined or so out of touch with reality that there's no way we can interconnect it. Therefore, there's no such, quote, courtesy or integration that we can perform. The thing is just simply flatly arbitrary. And you must have this nagging feeling that once you've said it's arbitrary, then it's up to you to really hammer the nail home. Once you said it's arbitrary, that's out. Any integration you do should be for yourself by way of maybe explanation or commentary on the sad state of people who had come up with these constructs, but not as part of getting rid of them as a claim. That's very important. And then the onus of proof, which has been around for a long time, way before objectivism. I don't think I have to say much, or at least I'll leave that for the question period if I do. Agnosticism, that is the essence of the error of agnosticism, is stated on 256 at the top. Agnostic is not simply the claim I don't know. And this, of course, is broader than God. It applies to all these people who cherish, pursue, and enshrine not knowing. Agnosticism is valuing, pushing, and insisting upon not knowing as the normal state. And, of course, the essence of that position is to, as I say in the top sentence, to take arbitrary claims and give them all the attributes of cognitive claims. Something that we should consider, discuss, judge, evaluate, file, classify. And of course, that is exactly what we shouldn't do. He thinks you can say, maybe these claims are true, but we don't know. And of course, in applying maybe and true and all these other terms, and here's, I think, my best description in this sequence, he is applying cognitive descriptions to verbiage that is at war with cognition. And that, I think, captures the essence of what is wrong with agnosticism and with any claim to assess the arbitrary. And therefore, I come to the final conclusion that we were right from now a different aspect on the need of logic as man's method. If you reject logic, go for the arbitrary. Not only you can't claim it as knowledge, the thing is outside the whole field of cognition. To a rational being, it's as though it hadn't been said. And thus my line near the end on 257, you cannot reach truth any more than knowledge by accident, by luck, by just pulling it out of a hat. Truth is a certain relation between your conceptual product and reality, which means between your mind and reality, which means for a rational being by having gone through a certain method. And if you don't go through that, what you have as a result is noise. Maybe it's noise whose meaning we can understand, but it's noise in the sense that it's detached from reality and it has no status, true or false. All right, let's take our break here, and then we'll have questions after the break. All right, let us pick up. I had a written question at intermission, which is interesting. I'd like to comment on before we throw open the arbitrary section. And it says, in three places you refer to man as submitting to nature, conforming to reality, acquiescing in facts, I guess. Would Ayn Rand have used any of these terms? As I understood her writings, man approaches nature with his head up and simply recognizes what is given. Nature is the condition he recognizes, not an authority which restricts him. Well, I think I understand your intention, and I agree with what one possible meaning, but I disagree very much with another. So let's look at this. If you take these terms, submit, conform, acquiesce, as meaning doing something against your will, being basically against reality and then saying, well, what the hell, what can I do? That's the way things are, I just have to accept it. If you take those terms that you quoted as meaning that, then no, those would not be appropriate terms because we don't believe there is an inherent conflict between consciousness and existence. So in recognizing reality, we are not, quote, obeying an authority contrary to our own desire. Now, sometimes anybody, by a specialized context, can find himself in rebellion against things as they are, even metaphysically. And he can regret simply by he strongly wanted something, and even though he sees the inevitability of the opposite for the moment, he dropped that knowledge. And that gets closer to the point where what a rational person does is recall a context and say, like it or not, this is the way things are. For instance, if you're in regard to death, as an example. But that is not the norm. So if you take submission and so on in that sense, no. But I was using it in a different sense throughout. In the sense of trying to bend over backwards to hammer home the primacy of existence. In other words, I'm trying to make the point that apart from anybody's desires or non-desires, the universe is not a metaphysical democracy. It's not as though existence casts a vote and consciousness casts a vote in terms of the course that we should follow intellectually or in existential action. Existence sets the terms. It's the master. And all of our consciousness consists of recognizing what it is and acting accordingly. Our eye is continuously on what's out there. What does it mean how we should run our minds? What does it mean how we should take our actions? And the goal of all our actions is what? To stay alive, which means to stay in the realm of existence. So that sets our goals, our means, our thought, and all of the complexities we go through, for instance, in concept formation. We contribute the process, the measuring, etc., but it's in order to perceive what's out there. And in that sense, consciousness is metaphysically subordinate. That's what I'm trying to stress by using terms like you submit, you acquiesce, you conform. That is the metaphysical fact. You can do it blissfully, happily, or you can do it regretfully, but that is not inherent in those terms. But the fact is, you have to do it. Your consciousness is dependent upon existence, and conforming to it is the form of being aware of it, which is what your consciousness is an organ for doing. And therefore, those terms are deliberate, but I hope that they don't necessarily carry with them the implication of a regretful capitulation. Okay, questions now on the arbitrary. Yes, at the back.
The only thing I'm troubled with in this is you give the example of a carrot saying 2 plus 2 equals 4.
Yeah.
And then a couple of lines below that you said that...
What, can you give me a page?
Yes, page 249.
249, okay.
That's the only thing that troubles me in this is that you say that
when it says 2 plus 2 equals 4, because it's not really consciousness saying this, that this above, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4 lines below that, you say, what it said was not truth or falsehood.
What it created was not truth or falsehood, right.
I don't understand that, because isn't there an objective truth?
No, sir. Let me answer that one. You say, you don't understand why I say the parrot did not create truth or falsehood when it said 2 plus 2 equals 4, because isn't it an objective fact that 2 plus 2 is 4, whether the parrot knows anything or not? Now, you are switching context inadvertently there. It is an objective fact that 2 plus 2 equals 4, whether we know it or not as a fact. We don't create that fact. That simply is a fact. When you describe it as true or false, when you give a cognitive assessment, which is what we have to do if we're talking about knowledge, then you're bringing in consciousness. Facts exist independent of consciousness. But truth or falsehood does not. Truth is the recognition of fact. Falsehood is contradiction to fact, going the opposite to fact. And in both cases, we are talking about a relationship, positive or negative, between a consciousness and reality. Without man and without the proper mental processes, no proposition is true. All you can say is, there are like the shapes of a dead language, you know, a language that nobody knows. If you came up with one of those manuscripts, you do not know what they stand for or how they were reached. That's neither true nor false within your context of knowledge. Now, if you then discover the key to how to decipher it, and they reveal or you can figure out the processes which led to these conclusions, at that point there is now a connection. Those conclusions become now the content of a consciousness which relates to reality or which defies reality, either way, and they become true or false. But the fact that those shapes exist moldering on the page or that the noises come out of the parrot is completely outside of cognition or the relation of a consciousness to existence. The parrot perceives existence, but to it, 2 and 2 is 4 is noise. To you listening, it's not the same thing as what he says, and that neither of that is relevant to facts. All facts, if they're facts metaphysically, are true whether we're here or not. But that's not what we're talking about in regard to the arbiter, you see. We're talking about truth or falsehood. We're talking about cognitive assessment, which is what the only way we can get to facts. You can't talk about facts except our means of knowing. And we have to go through a certain process and then say, yes, we hit the jackpot. This does correspond to fact. That's why the concept truth, you see. Okay, yes.
On the principle of page 248, you give Ayn Rand's definition of truth.
Yeah.
And then you say, in essence, it's the same as the correspondence theory, sort of implying that there's a subtle distinction.
Well, good for you, okay. On 248, I give Ayn Rand's definition of truth, and then I say, in essence, this is the traditional correspondence theory of truth. Why do I say in essence? Am I implying there is some kind of distinction? Well, there are a lot of different versions of the correspondence theory of truth. In broad principle, they share the idea that the proposition has to relate to reality, as against, for instance, the pragmatic theory, that the proposition has to produce satisfaction upon human beings when they act on it, or as against the Hegelian theory, that the proposition has to cohere with other propositions. You just have a world of free-floating propositions. In that broad sense, she's within the correspondence tradition, which goes way back to the Greeks. But it's been interpreted in so many different ways, down to the moderns, who have tried to claim in some cases that every element of a proposition has a separate element corresponding, in fact, to which it corresponds to. So if I say, A stitch in time saves 9, the A corresponds to an anus out there, and a stitch corresponds to a stitch, and in corresponds to an in, you know. And then there's people like Bertrand Russell who says that there's molecular facts, atomic facts, negative facts. You, universal facts, Christmas facts, you name it. Any time you can find a statement, if the correspondence is true, there must be, you know, a metaphysical exact point-by-point counterpart of that statement. Now, if you interpret correspondence that way, that you're making a hash of the distinction between metaphysics and epistemology. You see, and it becomes, you're giving propositions a life of their own without any reference to what they are, what are concepts, what is consciousness, and then the correspondence theory becomes nonsense. So I'm trying to indicate she retains the knowledge of what is consciousness, what are concepts, what is a proposition, a conjunction of concepts into a statement. And within that framework, she says that truth is correspondence to reality, but the key word there is recognition. Because recognition is not something a proposition does. Recognition is something a mind does. Proposition simply is the form in which a mind, when it uses the right method, recognizes reality. So the essence of truth is a cognitive relation between the mind and reality, you see, in the form of through a proposition which corresponds. But a corresponds is too vague if it allows things like Bertrand Russell, views like Bertrand Russell. And it's for that reason I say, in essence, it's the same idea. But I think the word recognition is superior because it keeps in mind the process. Now, in that sense, truth and knowledge are coextensive as concepts. There are differences in the aspect. Knowledge, you're thinking of the product as reached by a certain process. Truth, you're thinking of the product as representing a certain relation to reality. That's the essential distinction. Knowledge, she defines, I give that on page, 275. A mental grasp of a fact or facts of reality reached either by perceptual observation or by a process of reason based on perceptual observation. Now there is what knowledge is, and on the conceptual level, whenever you formulate a proposition which you want to state represents this relation to reality, you talk about it as true. But basically they're the same. While we're on this, by the way, I might just comment on the word grasp, which is Ayn Rand's word, of course. And I asked her once why she used grasp in this definition. And she said she wanted to suggest the idea of sharply distinguishing a given item or conclusion, concept, from its surroundings as against the prenatal stage of knowledge. Now, she used to call it the prenatal stage. That is, informing a concept or informing a conclusion. You do not go, assuming you're not just being taught it in the blue by somebody else, but you're reaching it on your own, you don't go from ignorance and then, without any transition, knowledge. You go through what she called a prenatal stage of groping, acquiring impressions, getting a sense that there is something here to know, that it includes this, oh no, it doesn't include that, bringing it more and more into focus, and then at a certain point you are able to grasp the essence, make the integrations, and you grasp. You see, it starts and ends here. This is what it is. This is where it comes from. At that point, you've gone past that groping to what she calls a grasp. And she used to give me the example of Rourke's original conversation with the dean and the feeling there's something different about the dean. There's some principle underlying his behavior, but he didn't know what. He had an impression, a sense. He didn't know about second-hander or dependence or all the rest at that stage of the game, but he had a feeling there's something about the dean, but he couldn't say as against Peter Keating or including Peter Keating or as against Gail Wynand or including in a form. I mean, it was at a stage where he didn't know exactly whether what it included or didn't. He was in that prenatal stage. But then at the end of the book, when he gets up and says, you know, the parasite versus the creator, now he knows because he's taken that preliminary impression and turned it into a firm, clearly differentiated grasp of a certain phenomenon. That's all that is supposed to be suggested or intended to be suggested by the use of grasp as the broad term characterizing knowledge. I guess that got away from your question. Let's take one more on the arbitrary, especially if anybody is bothered by simply dismissing something and not having to refute it. Is anybody bothered by that? Are you? Okay, go ahead.
Is there a difference between an invalid concept and a floating abstraction?
Oh, absolutely. Is there a difference between an invalid concept and a floating abstraction? An invalid concept is a concept that is, by its nature, unrelated to reality. By the very nature of the attempt, there is no way to bring it into relation to reality. Because it either represents an error, a contradiction, or a deliberate equivocation. Like ghost, for instance, or extremism, where there's no way to bring those back to factual basis. So you could call invalid concepts floating abstractions, but they're floating by their very nature. Now, normally when we describe something as a floating abstraction, we mean it's a legitimate concept. But in a particular person's mind, the concretization has not taken place, or the reduction to reality. Therefore, he himself uses it as an invalid concept. But that doesn't mean the concept is necessarily invalid, not as used by other people. So many people, for instance, use the term free, freedom, floating, but that doesn't make freedom an invalid concept. What it means is you've got to define it and reduce it. It doesn't make freedom into the equivalent of ghost, you see. You could say floating abstraction is the wider term. I wouldn't offhand think to call an invalid concept floating, because by calling it floating, the suggestion is bring it down to earth. And since it's invalid, it's out to begin with. There's no use then trying to bring it down because you're saying it's gone forever. So I would say that invalid preempts the field there. Yes.
Someone who's claiming the arbitrary. In your chapter on the virtues and the kingdom of judgment, do you deal with the issue of judging a person who's engaged in an arbitrary?
Do I deal with the in my chapter on virtue with the people who accept the arbitrary? Well, by implication, and in many different forms I do, but there's no separate virtue that says it's wrong or evil to accept the arbitrary. As a matter of fact, I wouldn't even go so far as to say that everybody who accepts something arbitrary is dishonest in so doing. He's naturally, necessarily committing a gross epistemological blunder. That's no matter what. And his conclusion does not represent any cognition or any cognitive status. But the extent to which epistemology is in chaos and people are not taught, you know, the means of cognition, I believe leaves open in many cases whether a person held something arbitrary simply out of helplessness or did it deliberately. That's a separate question. Now, there are even people out of, I think, honest error who believe that certain things have to be arbitrary because they can't dream of any way of proving them. You know, there are people, for instance, who believe morality has to start somewhere and they just don't have, you know, Ayn Rand's ability to take it back to reality. So there's certain things you just have to be honest, say. That's arbitrary. Maybe they'll say honesty is the best policy, or maybe they'll just say, I don't know why, you just have to be it. So that as they formulate it, that is arbitrary. But that doesn't make them immoral. It means they're helpless. Now, it does put them in trouble. See, if they take it as a categorical dogma like that, they don't know how to be honest in practice. They have no context, etc., and so on. So they don't escape the consequences, but that doesn't make it immoral. Where it becomes immoral is when someone more sophisticated, like a philosopher, although not only them, an intellectual, let's say, who deals with ideas and whose whole modus vivendi is how to, you know, arrive at truth, when they start flaunting the arbitrary, or you do it, you know, as a means of escaping reality and getting some super mysticism, then that's immoral. But then what makes it immoral is evasion is involved, you see. But if evasion is not involved, I do believe, and in fact I believe you can assert the arbitrary sometimes without knowing it. For instance, in my more rationalistic days, I would give a case for something. And I thought it was a good case. You know, it started with quote self-evidences and deduced in a vacuum. And then I would go to Miss Rand and say, what do you think of this? And she'd say, that's perfectly arbitrary. And I'd say, what do you mean it's arbitrary? I got premises and a conclusion. And she'd say, yeah, but the premises consist of accepting X blindly. Why did you accept it? I didn't even know that it was there. You know, now that is possible any time, so in that sense you can't equate the arbitrary with immorality unless the arbitrary becomes your religion, you know, the way it is for so many intellectuals today. Well, I mean religion in the broad sense. And then it becomes immoral. I think I'd take one more on the arbitrary because we still have to get certainty in. Does anybody feel a problem with this issue? Oh no, you asked the question, so let me answer that. I forgot your first part of your question. You want to know why is it that sometimes you can connect an arbitrary proposition to the rest of human knowledge as a courtesy and sometimes you can't. And the only answer I can come up with is it depends how utterly detached it is from the rest of our concepts. If it's defined in terms of valid concepts, then usually we can find, if we try, some link between the concept and other concepts. Now, for instance, God is not valid concepts, we mean omniscience and omnipotence. But there is such a concept as the ability to act, there is such a fact that we can grant the ability to know. You know, we know all kinds of things about that, and what they're trying to do is take a known human attribute and raise it, stripping away the conditions that make it possible. So there's enough of a relation in that usage. Now, of course, once they go beyond, and very quickly theologians go beyond, you know, the ordinary Judeo-Christian usage of God into negative theology and into beings that can't be defined, etc., then you can't any longer. Then there's no longer any contact between human concepts. Or even such a thing as, if I tell you, there may be a connection to human concepts, but absolutely no means of verifying it either way because of physical problems of verification. That would be another reason why you simply couldn't do it. If somebody makes an arbitrary claim about outer space, which would be such that you could verify it if you went to outer space, but right now it's like another dimension, we can't get to it. That then can't be brought into relation, you see. So there could be a variety of reasons, either the nature of the claim or the requirements of integration are physically beyond us. And in other cases, that problem doesn't obtain. But it's an accident of the type of arbitrariness and the type of development that we've reached. It doesn't pertain to one has got a basis in fact and the other hasn't. All right, now we got to, in our last half hour, look at certainty. And then we'll come out under the wire. Now, the big point that I want to make in regard to certainty is to stress, let's put it this way, that it's a good thing that knowledge is limited. That's the most provocative way I can put it. There are a lot of people that bewail the fact that knowledge is limited. And they feel, well, of course, if we're talking about a limited being, a being with limited consciousness like man, of course his certainty has to be contextually specified, but that isn't really certainty. Real certainty. Not this diluted objectivist version which specifies the context, but real certainty would be simply a categorical absolute without the need of qualifications and context and so on. And therefore they feel in their mind, when objectivism talks about Contextual certainty, that's a weak version of certainty, or an arbitrary definition of certainty, whereas the real meaning would be, this is it, don't bother me about context and limitations and so on. Now, I've heard that over and over again, and I can answer it by going back to, what does being limited mean? We've already discussed that, I don't want to repeat, but limited is a application of identity to quantity. A thing has only so many attributes, and each has only a specific size or range. And if you understand the relation of existence and identity, then you see that limit is inherent in existence. Now, it's very instructive historically. If you know that the Greeks, who were basically a rational civilization, the word limited connoted something good to them. It had positive connotations. They were complimenting a fact of reality when, or a human or whatever, when they said it was limited. Because to them, limited connoted finite, definite, knowable. On the other hand, the word that many of the early pre-Socratics used to describe what they thought of as an evil principle in reality was what? For instance, Anaximander called it the unlimited. And the unlimited for them conveyed something bad. The indeterminate, the infinite, that which is not definite, not specifiable, not graspable by man. Now, this was actually the original root of what became in Plato and Aristotle, the concepts of form and matter. And unfortunately, Aristotle's concepts derived from this, and matter was the unlimited element, and then form was imposed on matter and gave it a structure and thus an identity. And that was his form of the intrinsicism, you see, and that created all the problems of, despite himself, carrying on the mind-body dichotomy. But nevertheless, the relevant point here is that the Greeks were solidly in favor of limited. Now, of course, the modern world is completely the reverse. If I say he's of limited intelligence, right away, bang, we take that to mean, you know, he's got a low, and so on. Whereas they say, he's got unlimited potential. Then, of course, you take that as all roads are open. Well, of course, we can't change the way the words are used now. But this switch in meaning came about with Christianity. It was when Christianity came in and said, everything in this world is no good. This is the world of limit. Whereas real reality is the infinite, the unlimited, God, that the complete metaphysical reversal took place. And unlimited came to be the good and limit the bad. So we must, if you're objectivist, go back to the Greeks. Anytime anything smells of being limited, that's good. And anytime it smacks of being unlimited metaphysically, that means non-identity, non-knowable, out, irrational. Now, if you could keep that firmly in mind, you would have no problem with certainty. Because contextual certainty is the kind of certainty reached by a limited consciousness. If you keep in mind that that means by any cognitive faculty that's capable of concepts at all, then you see right away there's no even way to imagine another kind of certainty. Because limitation is inherent in existence. And if you feel, oh no, but I want the kind of certainty that doesn't require limitation, you're falling back into the implicitly the Christian metaphysics, the rebellion against identity. So we can, let us say, look at now 264 to elaborate this a bit further. Certainty within a context means certainty established by means of certain relationships between your conclusion and other things you know. When we say a certainty is contextual, we mean we establish that certainty by saying so-and-so and so-and-so leads to it. Given this, assuming that, this is the conclusion. We carve out the propositions that it depends on, the knowledge we have within the context of which we're stating this conclusion, and then we relate our conclusion to it. So, contextual certainty means a certainty dependent on relationships. And the point I want to stress that I state on the bottom paragraph of 264, relationships are not the enemy of certainty. Or here I use the term absolutes, but the idea here is the same. There are many people who feel that if you have to relate something to a whole body of information, that already undercuts its absolutism. Their idea of an absolute is a revelation in the void. God said it and it is. But if you have to say A, B, C, D, E are the conditions and they lead to the conclusion, so long as those conditions obtain within the framework of those conditions, they go, well, it's tentative and so on. But actually, the complete reverse is true. If you get a bolt from the blue in a void, just a claim, so-and-so is the case, that's like an arbitrary statement. There is no way to judge it, let alone to be certain of it. And we go back to the point that knowledge is relational. The only way you could hope to attain certainty would be by cementing this particular thing so thoroughly in so many different relationships to what you know that wherever you look, you're led back to this particular thing. So far from relationships being the enemy of certainty, they are what makes it possible. And so context is the precondition of certainty, not its invalidator. You can't isolate conclusions from the relationships that lead to them. If you want to, it means you don't grasp, to put it another way, the role of integration in knowledge. Whoever grasps that it's all one whole, would never have this, you know, unslakable thirst to find a proposition that's an absolute no matter what, without context. And of course, this doesn't apply to axioms, because there's where you start. So there you get directly from reality, but talking about anything beyond that level. So I draw the conclusion on the very top of 265, which I think is a good line here. Since we would know if a thing had no relations, we would know nothing that makes it so, we could count on nothing to keep it so either. And therefore, contextualism does not mean relativism. That is the most important point to stress in this sequence. Now, let me see if there are any last points before we I'm going to make only if I see any that I can't resist making. Well, I call your attention on 266 and 7. We're discussing possibility and then probability and certainty. This is a new point, the definition of evidence. It's on the bottom of 266, that bottom paragraph. That is not mine, but the dictionaries. But I think it's clearly expressed thereafter. The important point that if you want to know whether something is evidence, you have to know what would proof be. And then relative to that, you can say this item advances, this item does not. But if it's a conclusion that by its nature is beyond proof, as a supernatural being, there is no such thing as evidence then for it. It's a stolen concept. If you see a miracle, that is not, I mean, assuming that you saw one, that wouldn't be evidence for any supernatural being. If there's no proof conceivable, if you can't define what you mean by proof, there's no way of talking about a part proof. Not that you could see a miracle, but that's the stolen concept involved in trying to construct evidence for something which by its nature transcends nature. It's in the nature of evidence. And I've already commented on the importance of the distinction. It is possible for man, it is possible that this man, this is pretty much from the lectures. Oh, one thing on 270 I definitely want to point out. The first full paragraph. I say the concept of certainty designates knowledge from a particular perspective. Now notice I say it designates some complex items of knowledge. I do not believe that in its primary purpose, that is the basic reason why we need the concept certain, it's applicable to all knowledge. Otherwise, we have all sorts of terms to indicate freedom from doubt. But I think certainty has a specific purpose. A great deal, if all knowledge, let's put it this way, we're on the level of percepts, axioms, philosophic principles, mathematical principles. That is to say, either direct observation, direct self-evidence, or deductive derivation, therefore, not all philosophic principles, but the ones at the base. If it was all either axioms or corollaries, or as in math, deductive consequences, or direct observation, then you would either know or you would have made a mistake or not know. There would be no part knowing, more knowing, and all knowing. There would be no going through a continuum. But in complex cases, when you employ induction, that's where the question comes up. In some cases, because there are more elementary cases where you form complex conclusions, but you don't go through stages, particularly if you learn from others. But in many, but not all, complex cases, you definitely have more than just two stages. And there, I think, is when you go through. First you get some evidence, and it might be the case. And then you get more, and it's likely the case. And then finally, you say, I've hit the jackpot. Now, it's knowledge. And certainty has its primary point in designating the terminus of a process that started with a lesser stage of cognition. As I say, if it were only the perceptual, or the axiomatic, or the deductive, I don't think the concept certain would ever arise. Whatever be necessary. I would never say, in the normal course of affairs, if it weren't for polemics, it would be pointless to have a concept saying, I'm certain that Professor Buechner is sitting there. I would simply say, I see him. I know it. And there's nothing more I would add by saying, on top of that, I'm certain of it. I mean, there would be no point that I'm trying to cover. Now, the reason, of course, that we now insist on we're certain is because we know the world is lurking full of skeptics who are ready to say, you can't be sure. So we bend over backwards and say, I haven't the least doubt in the world. But normally doubt wouldn't even come up. You know, so you wouldn't need a concept to say, and I don't doubt it, any more than you'd have a concept to say, and I'm not scratching my head every time that I look at him. I mean, it wouldn't come up. They would see him and that's it, the way animals do on the perceptual level. Doubt, properly speaking, arises in complex matters when there is no clear path to follow and you start with a certain amount of data. You have to have some. If you have nothing, it's arbitrary, there's no doubt. But you don't know which way to go and how to get there. But you have to know two things. You have to start with some information, and you have to know what you would take as the end of the road. That's the point. You have to know what proof is. And then is when you say, I have doubt, I have less doubt, I've hit the jackpot. That's where certainly it's in that context that I think it's valid. And that's why the concept is important. But, of course, you can say all your knowledge is certain simply to strike out against doubt. But that is not the primary usage of the concept. I think I'll pass on any further comments. Let me just see, before I throw it open to questions, if there's anything in the last polemical sequence that is worthy of comment. I think it's all pretty straightforward. Perhaps the only noticeable last comment I want to make is on 279. And that is why you cannot compromise between reason and emotionalism. I think that last full paragraph. Who is going to decide on the terms of the compromise? And I think that's clearly put here. Reason can't be the deciding factor because reason would throw subjectivism out of court altogether. So feeling has to be the deciding factor because, you know, you could do whatever you feel like. Feeling is promiscuous. And so the middle of the rotor, despite his attempt to find a compromise, is really a thoroughgoing emotionalist. In exactly the same way that the middle of the rotor in politics, despite his attempt to find a compromise, is really a statist and will lead to total statism in actual practice. And on this foundation, there's a whole discussion in later chapters about the role of principles and what happens when you compromise a principle. And particularly, I finally cash in on this in the virtue of integrity and in what way the virtue of integrity is a necessity of the conceptual faculty and tie in their concepts, absolutes and virtue. But that's, I happen to like this, that chapter 8 is double the length of any other chapter. It's about 120 pages and it's about a 15 or 20 page discussion of each virtue with, if I say so myself, a lot of good points, tying them all back to the foundation. I enjoyed that by far the most of everything after chapter 4. I say that, so to speak, as in case you hadn't planned to get the rest of the book. I definitely recommend chapter 8. But this is as far as we can go on commenting today. Now we have a good 10 minutes. Let's first take any questions on certainty or that sequence. Yes, against the wall.
I have a question about the relationship of certainty, objectivity, and error.
Yes.
And in their lecture you gave on lectures on moral virtue, you gave a very fascinating discussion of how you corrected an error about the concept of independence.
Yes.
And the moral I took from that was that you can, with the best will in the world, I think that was your phrase, follow objectivity and still make error.
Oh, absolutely. Let me just say yes to that.
But if persistent integration, eventually, it will be self-correcting.
Correct. Exactly.
So my question is...
Can I repeat that much before your question, because I'll forget
it.
He says, can you be objective, thoroughly objective, and make an error? Absolutely. Objectivity is a norm. It's the principle that should guide you. It does not make you infallible. You can be objective, use logic, go by all the evidence within your knowledge, and come up with a mistake for a variety of different reasons. That doesn't make your process non-objective. It makes it wrong. But because it's objective, you will, if you continue, find the evidence. Since all knowledge is integrated, if you keep integrating, you're going to be given signals over and over that something here clashes. And the example that he cited was, I gave a lecture elsewhere on the virtue of independence, how I did it the first time, and then the mistakes I made, and how I redid it. And inherent in that lecture was, because I used a certain objective process in reaching it the first time around, and the more I worked with it, the more I saw inconsistencies, loose ends, unexplained points, unanswered questions springing up in all directions. Now that very data led me to think I must be something wrong. So continuous application of objectivity brought me back to a different approach. So they are self-correcting, but not overnight, you know. And it doesn't mean you can't have an error which for the moment doesn't erupt in consequence. So you say, how do you know you didn't make it then? You That's the issue of the arbitrary. You can't assert it's possible until you have a basis. As soon as you have a basis, then you don't have to worry, because now you know what direction to go to look further. Now you can ask your question.
I think you partly answered already, but two parts. Were you certain of your previous concept when you formed your previous concept?
Well,
secondly, how did you decide when the self-corrective process on the concept of independence was adequately completed, when it reached its terminus?
You both those questions are the same question. And the question is this. If it's true that you can make a mistake, were you really certain at the time you said you were? Well, that is exactly the same as saying. You said it was true, but it wasn't. You said you were certain, but you weren't. Well, okay, absolutely. I thought I was certain, but I wasn't. I actually made a mistake. Just as I thought it was true, but it wasn't. I made a mistake. But now, of course, I have no qualms about admitting that. But he says, how do you know you're really certain now? You thought it was okay then, and you think it's okay now. Now, what is that? So how do you know tomorrow it was, there's still another way? Now, especially me, having gone through so many different formulations and editing, how do you know it's not going to happen tomorrow? Now, what would you answer to that? What?
I'm looking for advice about the method by which you made decided that.
There's only two ways I can answer. How do I know it's not happening right now with every sentence I utter? I have reasons for what I say, which I'm stating in the process. That's how I know. And then you say, but maybe there's something you don't see. Show me that it isn't there. And that is covered exactly in page, where is that? Right at the end of the arbitrary. Where he says, I can't see the difference. Yeah, but I had it very well worded and I can't find it now. But there was a passage where I said, oh, I'm way up in the wrong section. Is that far ahead? No, that isn't the passage. That is the same problem. But it comes down to this. If you cannot see any distinction between your argument and a perfectly valid one, nor can the challenger, he can't say to me, prove that you are not committing this undetectable error. You cannot go from man is capable of error to you may be wrong in this instance, no matter how many times you've been wrong in the past. Because whenever you were wrong, the fact that you could grasp you were wrong, if you use the right method, means you're getting more on the track of the truth. You see, if I just went flop from one gross error to another, there would be something wrong with my method. But my actual experience has been that if you make an error, you'll learn something from it. And that's inherent in saying, I see what's true as against this, which is an error. That's in the process of calling it an error. Now you're not going to make that kind of error again. You are, even if you're going to still amend and correct, if there are aspects of your conclusion that you haven't yet corrected, you're still closer, and that very closeness enables you at a later point to grasp the later connection. So you are absolutely entitled to say, you know, if and when that you have evidence that you don't, in that act, you know again, and that's it. You can't get out from under that and say, well, it's not satisfying. What I really want is to get God's viewpoint. I want to know what an omniscient being would say about this point. It's not enough that I'm getting close to reality and I'm adding new aspects. I want to know what I would say if I knew everything. That is another way of insinuating the unlimited. Not that you're doing it deliberately, but that's what it amounts to. It's a question governed by the idea that the unlimited would be great. But since we haven't got that, how can we ever be satisfied with cognition as we have it? And so I take a very cavalier attitude. My attitude is like this. I made 100 mistakes in the past, but I'm right on this. And if this is wrong next time when I find that out, I'll say I've made 101 mistakes, but it's right this time. That's it. There's no other way. You just have to bite the bullet and commit yourself regardless of all the perils. If you can prove it, if you can, you know, establish the method, give an argument, and integrate. This is another aspect of why integration is so crucial. If I give a plausible answer, you see that, as I did on, this is a good test, but the trouble that I had with the virtue of independence, one of the problems I had when I did it originally, was that it came out as common sense. Anybody of the so-called Puritan ethic or whatever could agree with what I presented. And I felt it's funny to take a major virtue, objectivism is supposed to be such a revolutionary philosophy, and nothing of the foundation of the philosophy was relevant to it. In other words, what I was seeing, to use another term for it, was this was unintegrated to the metaphysics and epistemology. And therefore, it was just a meaningless presentation. And as soon as I saw that, I was put on the track. You see, temporarily it was a failure of integration. And the real, therefore, answer is if you come up with something out of context, just a little argument or presentation that sounds good, but you don't laboriously tie it to the rest of knowledge, the skeptic has a claim. But if and when you can tie it in, that is the decisive final answer. So we come back to integration as the crucial answer. And of course, then you have to do it within the limits of your knowledge. I have literally time for one last overall question. Does anybody have a question that might be appropriate as the finale? And the final note for the totality. At the very back of the center. Yeah.
When will the whole published book be in our hands?
Well, I guess that's appropriate. When will the whole book be available? Now, here I'm really going to answer contextually. The book is finished, but about four or five chapters need one more layer of editing. By the best of my knowledge, that is a process of about 2 months to edit that amount of material. I don't believe that editing is super indispensable. I mean, if I were run over by a truck, I would tell and have told my wife, publish it as it is, because it's true. It's just a little too wordy and awkward and so on. It needs one more coat of polish. Then two things have to be written. One is all the footnotes, including some historical asides and so on. That is a process of weeks. And then I have to write a preface, you know, explaining how I came to write the book and to what extent Ayn Rand should and shouldn't be held responsible and so on, things of that nature. So I estimate altogether there's about 3 months of full-time work. And then after that, the publisher takes 11 months from the time it's submitted to go through copy editing, galleys, distribution, etc. My original goal was to get it in September, for release in August of 91. Given the health problems, it looks like it's going to be closer to the end of October or November. So I can't really predict how long I'm going to be out and recovering and so on, but within everything possible to me, I'm definitely going to be in this fall at some point, which means it'll be out a month or so earlier next fall, so either September, or if worse comes to worst, October, but absolutely by November next year, you see, depending upon how fast I can do this last process. And I think I can say that as an absolute because I haven't done it by then. That'll mean I'm dead, in which case my wife will bring it out, so it'll come out anyway in the form that it's in now. That's just a joke. Is this on the point? Yeah. Yes. I was coerced into an index, yes. So, in fact, Linda Reardon is going to be doing the index. And I'm going to try to work with this book and, health permitting, go on tour with it when it comes out and try and give it some... hearing. Well, let me just say in conclusion that you've been a really wonderful audience. I've talked to objectivist groups for many years, and I have never encountered an audience before that has asked such consistently good, interesting, challenging but non-hostile questions, highly relevant and instructive. I cannot remember ever such an enjoyable group. I wish that I had, you know, been up to the top of my strength, but I did what I could, and I do very much thank you for coming, and I hope you got what you wanted out of it. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.